The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So with opium, you're looking at a significant number of people that would be dispossessed if you banned their crop. And I mean, previous opium bans in 2000, as you mentioned, and then the kind of subsequent localized bans under the Republic, they generally relied on favorable conditions, namely high wheat prices, low opium prices, along with drought. And wheat prices are very high now, admittedly, and drought is an issue. But the opium price isn't low at the moment. So the conditions that enabled those bans to work, at least in the short term, aren't entirely applicable now.
I'm Natalie Orpett, executive editor of Lawfare. And this is the Lawfare Podcast, September 14th, 2022. Amid the war and instability in Afghanistan over the last two decades, the opium industry has seen explosive growth. In fact, Afghanistan accounts for the vast majority of the world's opium supply. The Taliban vowed to crack down on the production of illicit drugs. In March, they issued a total ban on opium cultivation, which has stripped many rural Afghans of their livelihoods. But in the meantime, drug prices have been increasing, making production and trafficking of methamphetamines even more profitable. To discuss the situation, former Lawfare Associate Editor Tia Sewell sat down with Rupert Stone, an independent journalist who recently published a piece with the Atlantic Council entitled "Afghanistan's Drug Trade is Booming Under Taliban Rule." They discussed how Afghanistan's drug trade has evolved under the Taliban, the growing problems of addiction, and how the Taliban's rule has affected the export and trafficking of illicit drugs in the broader region. It's the Lawfare Podcast, September 14th, Rupert Stone on the booming Afghan drug trade.
To start us off, can you explain how poppy production has changed over the past year? In other words, how has the Taliban approached this illicit industry, and what has cultivation looked like since they came to power?
Well, basically, Taliban messaging on this issue has fluctuated since the takeover last year and vowed to ban drugs in no uncertain terms. The spokesperson, Zabihullah, at a press conference, literally a day after the takeover, I think, said that they would ban narcotics. And then later that year, the spokesman came out on record and said they couldn't ban opium without first providing farmers with alternatives. And then they switched again, and in April this year imposed a sweeping unconditional drug ban, which prohibits the production, trade, and consumption of all narcotics. So the rhetoric's changed, but rhetoric aside, the Taliban's essentially done very little to stop opium cultivation so far. Reports last year showed farmers continued to plant poppy. And in fact, cultivation seemed to be increasing. The trading of opiates continued in the open with little attempt to hide it. And as Afghanistan's economy collapsed due to the removal of foreign aid, which is most of the former government's budget, imposition of sanctions, freezing of central bank assets, etc., opium provided a lifeline to many poor Afghans. And also, importantly, it's quite resistant to drought, which is important in current circumstances. Now, the Taliban ban came after the main planting season in late 2021, and it quickly became apparent that the regime would allow the summer harvest to proceed despite the ban. However, the decree did cause prices to rise, although they've since fallen back a little bit. So that's a kind of broad overview of how things have been on the opium front in the last year.
Thank you so much. I want to dive a bit more into this decision by the Taliban to instate a ban. So as you know, the history of the Taliban and the opium industry in Afghanistan is incredibly complicated. The Taliban taxed traffickers in the 1990s to then instating the first successful narcotics ban back in 2000, to then allegedly taxing poppy farmers to fund insurgent operations over the past two decades. So walk me through it. If you're the Taliban, why reverse course now and instate a ban in your first year of governance, particularly when you have extremely limited state resources, compounding economic and environmental crises, and an unprecedented number of Afghans dependent on this industry now for their livelihoods?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And there are a number of reasons I can think of. I mean, the first one is we shouldn't forget the religious motive. I mean, the Taliban is generally very strict, as is widely known, and they view drug abuse as morally wrong. So there's that motive to begin with. Banning drugs also reinforces their reputation as tough on law and order and boosts their legitimacy by differentiating them from the previous government, which was notoriously corrupt and could never eradicate drugs. Far from it. The drug trade boomed under the Republic. Drug use is a social crisis in Afghanistan, and there's an urgent need to address it. That's another reason. And perhaps the most important, in my view, is that banning drugs could possibly gain the Taliban foreign aid and legitimacy. They clearly want development assistance, given the state of the economy, and a drug ban might be a way of getting it. I mean, when they banned drugs in 2000, they are promised aid and received some funding from the US government, which appeared to be a reward for outlawing drugs. Prohibition could also help win recognition from foreign governments. I mean, so far, the regime hasn't been recognized by any government, and banning drugs and kind of implementing UN drug conventions could be a way for the Taliban to play ball and try and gain some international credibility. And it's not just Western governments that the Taliban wants to impress. They set up an anti-trafficking unit near the Tajik border late last year, for example, which is likely an attempt to placate China and Russia, which worry about narcotics entering their territory via Central Asia. So there are various reasons for imposing the ban.
Absolutely. And a lot of those reasons seem to be pretty external facing insofar as establishing legitimacy. I guess, in your opinion, has this ban been more of a rhetorical show of legitimacy, or do you see that the Taliban are actually taking concrete steps to counter the trade right now? And if so, what are those steps?
I would say so far it's largely been symbolic, but not entirely symbolic. They have, the Taliban regime has issued quite a lot of propaganda, presenting an image of aggressive drug control. The Ministry of Interior earlier this year posted a photo on Twitter of a tractor tearing up a poppy field, for example. They ostentatiously staffed up their counter-narcotics police after taking over, disseminating a video of that. And they sometimes publicize drug seizures and arrests. But I wouldn't call the Taliban's drug control efforts solely illusory. They are clearly doing things. For instance, they've shut some drug processing facilities in Helmand and Kandahar in the south, which is really the epicenter of the Afghan opiate trade. There was one report earlier this year that I think 60 to 70% of the heroin processing facilities in a border town in Helmand on the Pakistani border remained operational. But still, that showed you that the Taliban had shut quite a few of them down, reportedly. They did move also to eradicate some of the second opium crop of this year, which is much smaller than the first crop, which is planted in the fall. The second crop is planted later in the spring. And it's compared to the first crop, it's very, very small and used not even to be recorded. But nonetheless, it is a reality, and the Taliban are doing something by cracking down on it. An interesting analogy in this respect is the a little-known Taliban ban on cannabis cultivation in March 2020, which was obviously a year or so before the takeover. That seemed to deter some farmers from planting cannabis, but only in provinces where the plant wasn't particularly entrenched. In places like Kandahar, which had a lot of cannabis cultivation, one of Afghanistan's major cannabis-producing provinces, the ban just wasn't really enforced. So there's, I think, a parallel there that we can see a ban being selectively enforced, a lot of symbolism and largely ineffectual, but it does have some kind of minor impact and can't be dismissed as mere symbolism.
Right. Do you think that this will change moving forward? Do you think that, I guess, the enforcement of the ban will become more strong in the years to come, kind of reflecting on the previous prohibition in 2000, where, as you note in your article, it took the Taliban numerous attempts and some intricate arrangements with different power brokers to truly enforce that ban? Do you think that the situation moving forward for a successful prohibition would be the same now? Or has this trade grown into something much larger that will be kind of, frankly, impossible to pin down in the same way?
It depends on the drug you're talking about, really. I mean, basically, the Afghan drug trade can be simplified into opium or opiates, opium plus heroin, morphine, the main derivatives, methamphetamine. And cannabis; those are the three main things. So let's focus first on methamphetamine. I mean, they could possibly get away with a ban on meth and ephedra, its main natural ingredient, because the meth industry employs far fewer people than opium. It's only about 11,500, according to David Mansfield, who's probably the top expert on the Afghan drugs trade. So that's really not a lot of people. I mean, obviously, a ban would hurt those people, and it would be difficult for them, and it would have ripple effects in the economy, Afghan economy. But it'd be far less harmful than banning opium, which is, you know, a very labor-intensive crop that during the war employed 500,000 Afghans, more if you include part-time workers, more if you include the kind of service economy around the trade. And maybe even more now that the formal economy has collapsed. So with opium, you're looking at, you know, a significant number of people that would be dispossessed if you banned their crop. And I mean, previous opium bans in 2000, as you mentioned, and then the kind of subsequent localized bans under the Republic, they generally relied on favorable conditions, namely high wheat prices, low opium prices, along with drought. And wheat prices are very high now, admittedly, and drought is an issue. But the opium price isn't low at the moment. So the conditions that enabled those bans to work, at least in the short term, aren't entirely applicable now. The consequences of an opium ban could also be very deleterious for the Taliban, robbing so many poor Afghans of a livelihood without any economic substitute. Could fuel resistance against their regime, including from its own fighters, who are in some cases involved in opium cultivation. I mean, the 2000 ban angered farmers and would likely have collapsed if the Taliban had remained in power. I mean, there were already signs before 9/11 and the US intervention that year of arms being moved into the country and the first simmerings of violent resistance. So who knows what would have happened if it hadn't been for the Taliban's ouster that year. Militant groups could also exploit drug control efforts to strengthen their support, as the Taliban did during its own insurgency against the former Afghan government. I mean, when the government launched eradication campaigns, the Taliban presented itself as a protector of opium farmers whose crops were threatened with destruction. And so if the Taliban were to ban drugs, the tables could be turned and Islamic State or other militant groups could do the same to them, taking advantage of the grievances of farmers. So a drugs ban would be highly risky for the Taliban. It could threaten their hold on power. But they've not shown themselves to be wholly pragmatic so far. I mean, they banned girls from school, even though that decision enraged the development community and isolated the regime even more. So who's to say they won't take a self-destructive decision to ban drugs? That said, they could probably survive a drugs ban financially. The Taliban's far less reliant on drug revenues than people think. I mean, during the war, drugs were commonly portrayed as the movement's main source of funding. They were described as like a narco-terrorist group of a drug cartel. But those terms weren't really suitable because they earned less money from narcotics than other sources, for example, from taxing legal goods that moved through the territory they controlled. They earned more revenue, which was actually interestingly also the case during their previous regime, as they earned more money from taxing smuggled goods than from narcotics. And since taking power, they've managed apparently to reduce smuggling and boost custom revenues. So drug money is certainly substantial. It's not central to the Taliban's finances. I mean, they might decide to experiment with a ban, the Taliban, despite all these risks, on the assumption that they could roll it back if the effort backfires. But that would actually be a very risky move, because the global drug market's different from the 1990s when they were last in power and they last banned drugs. I mean, this time round, if they cut off the supply of Afghan heroin, dealers could switch to fentanyl, as happened in the US in a very short space of time. Afghanistan would then have lost its heroin market to opioids and gone the way of other opium producers. Specifically Myanmar and Mexico, whose plant-based drug industries were transformed by the synthetic drug revolution. I mean, synthetic drugs hold a number of advantages for traffickers over heroin. I mean, they're cheaper, more potent, less bulky, easier to smuggle. Production's not confined to specific geographies. It's not vulnerable to drought, disease. So if you make drugs in a laboratory, there are many advantages, and also it's secret, harder to detect. So given these benefits, drug experts think it's only a matter of time before fentanyl displaces heroin in Europe and also spreads to the Asia-Pacific region. So the Taliban, it could be damned if they do ban drugs, because they could lose their market to opioids, and damned if they don't, because they'll be left with a vast drug economy. So it's a hugely complex challenge.
I want to follow up on one thing that you mentioned in that answer, which is that there are really vastly different estimates for how much money the Taliban was actually making off of the drug trade during the war itself. And so just quickly, I'm curious, what in your view of this accounts for those disparities in figures in reporting, as we saw over the past 10 years specifically?
I think what one reason is the way the tax revenues are calculated. I mean, there's a mistaken view out there that I think it's OSHA, the Taliban agricultural tax, is a tax on value. So like 10% of the value of drugs, of opiates or whatever, where it's actually the way it's calculated is a tax on weight. And basically, if you calculate it as a tax on value, you inflate the figures and make it seem like they're earning far more money from drugs than they in fact are. And when you apply the right calculations, you get much lower figures. So just before the takeover, there was a report by David Mansfield again and Graham Smith, which was trying to assess the revenues for the Taliban and the former government in a single province on the Iranian border, Nimroz province. And they found that, I think, 80% of the Taliban's revenues came from taxing legal goods. through that province, and only 9% came from drugs. And interestingly, the government earned more revenue from drugs than the Taliban did. So, you know, when you calculate these things differently, it changes one's perspective.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So as opium production has soared over the past two decades, addiction rates in Afghanistan have followed and at an increasing rate worsened. I assume that's true for the other drugs that we're talking about in this broader drug trade. So I want to understand here how the Taliban is approaching not just the production of drugs, but also the use of drugs. Is there talk or reporting of punishment, or conversely, any discussion of demand-side reduction measures like drug treatment facilities in Afghanistan?
Yeah, again, good question. I mean, there's certainly a widespread drug use problem in Afghanistan, but the scale of it isn't really known, as there hasn't been a survey for years. I think data from 2015, which I believe is the last drug survey that was conducted there, it showed that more than 10% of Afghans were using drugs, and the country's thought to have some of the highest rates of drug dependency in the world. I mean, the evidence so far suggests that the Taliban's handling of drug users is brutal. And we've had videos of addicts being arrested, beaten, publicly doused in water, their heads shaven, and sort of marched around and then confined, often in prison. Which is certainly a very not an effective way of handling drug addiction compared to treatment facilities. And this is all reminiscent, actually, of the Taliban's previous spell in power in the 90s when they beat users as they are doing now. The Taliban broadcast these images of rounding up addicts, no doubt, again, to present itself as a kind of tough drug cop. But while the brutality can't be denied, they might be more negligent than they seem. I mean, many addicts are reportedly just left to die in the street and given no help whatsoever, not even arrest and confinement. There was a recent harrowing story by the Associated Press with photos of these people in, I think, in Kabul, just dying, drug addicts just left to die under bridges. Surrounded by stray dogs, and even the dogs were hooked on drugs. I mean, that's how serious a problem it is. And there was a drug treatment professional quoted in that story, as I recall, who said he thought the addiction problem was getting worse. But without survey data, it's hard to tell exactly how much worse.
Right. So I want to turn this discussion specifically to center on drug abuse among Afghan women and children, which, as you know, there hasn't been an official survey, but reporting shows that this has been a really massive humanitarian concern in recent years. So I want to ask, have you seen the Taliban signal in any capacity whether it may be committed to sustaining drug treatment centers specifically for these populations as a humanitarian matter, or whether it's kind of pursuing a one-size-fits-all crackdown on all users with those harsh measures? I guess specifically, have you seen any reporting on addiction treatment centers in Kabul being open specifically for women?
No, I haven't. I mean, there are addiction treatment centers. I mean, generally in Afghanistan, women don't have equal access to healthcare. So my assumption is that they wouldn't get the same access to these sorts of treatment facilities as men do. Which is a big problem, because if that's the case, because there is reportedly a major crisis of drug use by women and children in Afghanistan. I mean, I was reading that the number of female addicts is estimated to have increased by 600% in the last decade, according to the UN. And obviously, the war-related trauma is a big risk factor for substance abuse, among the many other problems that accompany life in Afghanistan these days, but especially for women. I mean, one thing is drugs are an antidote to hunger, which is at critical levels in the country. And they also serve as a sort of substitute, apparently, for medicine, given the lack of access to healthcare. And again, that's a problem that's more likely to be worse in the female population because women have poorer access to healthcare in Afghanistan. I mean, it should be said that Afghan women were suffering long before the Taliban took over. I mean, it's long been known as the worst country in the world to be a woman, and COVID made the situation even worse. I mean, women were stuck at home with abusive partners and relatives. And again, they didn't get proper access to healthcare during that time. Their employment opportunities were harmed even more. So all of these, this constellation of factors coming together now to make it a serious crisis, especially for women who are very susceptible to drug dependency. I mean, it should also be added that, Afghan drugs affect women in other countries too. A drug treatment professional in Pakistan told me that methamphetamine, much of which is smuggled into the country from Afghanistan, that use of methamphetamine by women trying to cope with domestic abuse and other stresses is a serious crisis in Pakistan at the moment. And I'm sure much of the meth that's being consumed there comes from Afghanistan. So this is a regional as well as a local issue.
I'm curious how outside researchers looking in at Afghanistan's drug trade have seen their work impacted by the Taliban's takeover, particularly as it strikes me that this regime would have some incentive to misrepresent cultivation data or, you know, limit survey access. Then again, I know that researchers like Mansfield have been able to generate really important research from satellite data alone. So is it your impression that it's become harder to study production trends in Afghanistan over this past year, or how has this effort changed?
Yes, is the simple answer. I mean, with the caveat that, I mean, the drug trade has always been partly concentrated in Taliban areas, so it was never especially accessible before, but it has become worse, I think. I mean, media reporting in under the Taliban regime is very challenging and increasingly dangerous, it seems. And I mean, they've detained a number of foreign and local reporters. And there have been recent scandals of reporters for Indian and American outlets being harassed and mistreated in some ways. There's still some reporting going on, including from Afghan outlets, but the space for kind of independent, informative coverage is shrinking fast. And that's very important because it makes it easier for the Taliban to disseminate propaganda, kind of monopolize the narrative and create this kind of alternative reality where they are actually cracking down on drugs and enforcing their drugs ban. And we have to be very wary of their efforts in this regard. I mean, they are, it's no endorsement of them, but they are very good at propaganda. I mean, it's one of the main reasons I feel why they won the insurgency. And you really have to watch out for it because it can be quite ingenious.
I want to move into another piece of this, which is its international dimension. And you present that in notable detail in your Atlantic Council piece. I'm curious, do you think that there's been a notable change in the export of Afghan drugs under the Taliban's rule?
Certainly, trafficking out of Afghanistan has continued at high levels, and it may well have increased. I mean, it's hard to tell with a clandestine trade like drug trafficking how much is going on, and we have to kind of construct a jigsaw puzzle, from drug seizure data, reports in the media, government reporting, price data, things like this, to piece a picture together of what's going on. We don't have kind of finished trade volumes that you get with legitimate commerce. But that caveat aside, it does seem like there's a lot of trafficking going on. Another thing to add on the outset there is that while there have been a lot of drugs seized in the region since the takeover, some of those drugs might have left Afghanistan before the change of government and then have sort of taken some time to work their way through the trafficking pipeline before they were seized. And drugs can be stored for a while and there can be, you know, time lags and delays in smuggling routes. So that's another thing to bear in mind. And also meth, you know, just because meth is seized in the region, it doesn't necessarily mean it came from Afghanistan. And there are other producing countries like the Netherlands. But the price of Afghan meth is so much lower than product from Europe because it's made with a plant. That means there's little commercial sense for regional traffickers to source their meth elsewhere when they can get it cheaply on their doorstep from Afghanistan. So anyway, those caveats aside, there have been very large seizures and seizures actually at the border with Pakistan and Iran. So, you know, when the drugs are leaving the country. So it's like it's clear that they're being trafficked out while the Taliban was running the country. Southeast Iran, for example, which is one of the main trafficking routes, probably the main trafficking route for drugs moving from Afghanistan to Europe. You've seen huge seizures there in the last year, including in recent months. There have been also talkum on the Afghanistan-Pakistan border, as I say in my piece. There were unprecedented seizures of heroin and meth late last year, early this year. And Pakistani law enforcement officials told me and other journalists that trafficking had increased since the Taliban took power. And then also the other side of the country, Central Asia, smugglings reportedly increased to Tajikistan, which saw a rise in seizures. And the Tajik anti-drug chief said again that trafficking had increased since the Taliban took power. And another important piece of the puzzle here, which isn't discussed enough, is India. Which is in a particularly vulnerable position vis-a-vis the Afghan drug trade. I mean, its government's very worried that trafficking will increase under the Taliban. We've already seen big seizures at ports in Western India since the takeover last year and this year. And even if the Taliban bans drugs, that could also be bad news for India because it has a large number of opioid users who could switch to fentanyl or other synthetic opioids like tramadol, which are actually produced in India. And while we don't have widespread evidence of fentanyl use in India, it could be happening without our knowledge. I mean, India doesn't report deaths comprehensively. So, you know, we found during COVID that the WHO estimated COVID deaths were 10 times higher, thereabouts 10 times higher than official reports. So these overdose deaths from opioids like fentanyl could be happening under the radar without our knowledge. And ultimately, we'd need to keep an eye out on that one.
So circling back to end our conversation on Afghanistan itself, what role do you think countries like the U.S. need to be playing here? Or how should foreign countries and NGOs be considering the drug trade in the context of allocating humanitarian aid for Afghanistan?
Yeah, that's a difficult question. I mean, there are never easy answers when it comes to drug control. Sometimes the best that can be done is just not to make things worse. I mean, the international community will no doubt be tempted to provide aid to Afghanistan in return for a drug ban to alleviate the impact on dispossessed poppy farmers. But attempts at alternative development, such as crop substitution, haven't worked well in the past. And they should be handled very carefully. And in the short term, the best approach might be just to focus on harm reduction, trying to improve the lot of addicts by providing better drug treatment facilities and supplies. I mean, these aren't major steps that will eliminate Afghanistan's drug problem, but they could help people. And even small forms of assistance are better than no assistance at all. mean, ultimately, the Afghan drug crisis will only be solved by economic development, and that's not really feasible as long as Afghanistan's sanctioned and cut off from the global economy. I mean, the international community should be prepared to lift sanctions if the Taliban moderates its policies, but there's no sign of that happening. I mean, quite the contrary. The regime's not only caused outrage with its treatment of women and girls, it was also caught hosting the chief of al-Qaeda, which has enraged the US and other countries. And as long as these sorts of policies continue, it's hard to see countries such as the US, along with Russia and China, which share concerns about terrorism, agreeing to lift UN sanctions. And until that happens, Afghanistan will remain isolated and impoverished, unfortunately. I mean, one solution that's been floated in the past is to legalize drug production in Afghanistan. I mean, the Taliban was in talks recently with a German firm to open a cannabis processing plant, but that won't be possible unless the Taliban regime is recognized and holds Afghanistan's seat at the UN, as legal drug production requires a license, and basically only recognized governments can acquire those licenses. There are many other obstacles to legalization, which we don't have time to get into beyond the licensing issue, but let's just say it's not a viable path. I mean, bottom line is Western countries should be cautious, encouraging the Taliban to ban drugs. I mean, a ban could destabilize Afghanistan again, plunging it into yet more violence and chaos, sending more refugees into neighboring countries, increasing the threat of terrorism, and ironically, creating perfect conditions for the return and subsequent expansion of the drug trade. And in addition, as we discussed, the drug ban could open the doors to an opioid crisis in Europe, which isn't to say that reining in Afghanistan's drug trade is the wrong approach. It just needs to be handled very carefully, gradually, within an overall framework of economic development and integration, and mindful of the failures of previous efforts during the Republic and before.
Right. So in other words, economic development necessary to really truly counter this drug trade in a meaningful way by providing economic opportunity for Afghans and enhancing stability within insecure regions really can't happen without more of an official recognition of the Taliban from the international community, in your opinion?
Yes, indeed. And that can only happen if the Taliban changes its policies. You know, I just don't see governments recognizing the Taliban with its current suite of policies. I could be wrong, but you know, even China and Russia and Pakistan, Iran, which aren't exactly known for their championing of human rights, have serious issues with the Taliban regime. So the isolation of the quote emirate, I fear, is going to persist for some time.
Well, we are going to leave it there. Rupert Stone on the drug trade in Afghanistan under the Taliban's rule. Rupert, thank you so much for coming on. Really appreciate it.
Not at all. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare material supporter at patreon.com/lawfare. You'll also get access to special events and other content available only to our supporters. Please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Look out for our other podcasts, including Rational Security, Chatter, Allies, and The Aftermath, our latest Lawfare Presents podcast series on the government's response to January 6th. And check out our written work at lawfareblog.com. The podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell, and your audio engineer this episode was Ian Enright of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yen. As always, thank you for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.